my teammates now that I've had enough to track.
Yeah.
And I actually had AI give me what a purple belt agent should look like.
School really didn't turn out. And so I had a lot of challenges there.
Mm-hmm.
But through sales is where I kind of found myself. And then through real estate, things started to really shake and move.
How did you end up in real estate? I don't know if I ever asked you that question.
Well, I dropped out of high school. And there's so many agents that are long in years and low in mileage.
Yeah.
And are you in a better position to work with somebody who has years of experience not doing this very often?
Yeah.
Or are you better to work with someone who may not be as long in this business, but has a lot of relevant and recent activity?
Yeah.
In this episode of Estates, Entrepreneurs, and Expressos, we get to sit down with the one and only Taylor Hack. He's a marketing strategist, a leader in the real estate industry. He speaks at a national level, an investor, a futurist, and he leads the Hack & Co. real estate team. I've had the pleasure of spending hundreds of hours masterminding with Taylor, and he's actually impacted many things about the way we do business at Prime. He's somebody that really understands the difference between being able to generate leads and service the listing and get those 5-star reviews. He shares a bunch of those secrets in this episode. Make sure to leave us a review to let us know that you are here. If you enjoy these episodes, we need the feedback. Also, big shout out to Leo Grant. He won last month's Prime Nation draw and he won a copy of the book, Choose Your Enemies Wisely. Maybe you could be next. Make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. Share this out and enjoy the show.
I was actually thinking about this the other day. Because one pivot I've made big time is I try writing in the morning. So like before I would wake up, water, vitamins, workout right away. But like ramp my heart rate up. And then I've been listening, reading Dan Coe's stuff a lot, The Art of Focus, phenomenal guy. Like follow him on Twitter. His book is coming out, I think, in about a month. And he keeps talking about like the ritual of writing. So like taking one idea and just, you can do morning pages where you just mind dump onto a page of everything in your life and then get into like a focused writing block. And I was looking at my schedule, I'm like, when's the best time to do that? And I heard somebody saying, leave your heart rate chill for like the first hour and a half of your day. And I'm like, I should probably just do it first thing in the morning. Cause that'd probably be a decent time where my brain's not humming at 1,000 RPMs or whatever, right? So three coffees back to back to back. So I had the last episode, I was wired. How are you?
I've definitely been in that position because like meetings are better with coffee.
Always.
And then you just associate it.
And then, or you go to the end of the day and you've had so much coffee that the last one makes you tired.
Yeah.
That happens to me once in a while.
Yeah. No, going back to what we were talking about in terms of competitive advantage, right? I think you see the same cycles in the real estate market too, where if you look at the different eras of real estate marketing, brokerage ownership, what it means to be an actual agent. You know, I think the eras tend to follow different patterns. So we were shooting an episode with Matt Leonetti and we were talking about how when we were both licensed, it was like, hey, message everybody you know on Facebook, tell them you're an agent. And it was very much funnel, old school sales driven. And then we went through the content era. It seems like we're going through the influencer era. And I feel like we're edging on the craftsman era again, where I'm seeing people like tacticians like yourself and other people that are very, very craftsmanship oriented to like the client experience or like the gamification of what you were saying you're doing with your team, where you like give them the ability to unlock things, right? I think that's a pretty cool place to be in our industry.
Yeah, I see us like moving from here into what we'll probably define as the artificial intelligence era. So that's what I really see as next.
Yeah.
And then where do you think the biggest opportunity zones would be in AI for real estate? The first thing is just to remember that the water rises from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the menial tasks, like I remember in my first year of real estate, I was calculating with a coach, and I guess the average person types on their phone at about 22 words a minute. But we send so many of the common text messages that through my keyboard shortcuts, I was saving a 40-hour work week annually against my competition.
Yeah.
So that was like a little bit of a technology hack just to kind of essentially like make time.
Yeah.
And making time is actually the whole goal.
Mm.
So I talk to teammates about this often, but there's a certain time where we know that they can do it, right? Where you're like, okay, you've got it. Now that's still like a pretty early level. As a jiu-jitsu practitioner, I think that the most effective definition of a blue belt is someone who we would expect as jiu-jitsu practitioners to win against any full-size untrained adult.
Yeah, it's fairly accurate.
That's the first graduation in an adult belt.
Yeah.
And it says that, yes, you were expected to win.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you go further, you start to see like some depth. Like purple belt makes a very different statement.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working with artificial intelligence, and this is going to be how, like, we don't know how it's going to progress. Because what I was trying to solve is, when I look at my teammates, what belt are they?
Mm-hmm.
How do I know that I've cleared the criteria to give them the next belt?
Mm-hmm.
So I took the definition of jiu-jitsu belts and the KPIs and graduation movements of my teammates, now that I've had enough to track.
Yeah.
And I actually had AI give me what a purple belt agent should look like.
That's awesome. What did it output? Like, what are the components of a purple belt agent?
Well, I think that, like, in the progression, a white belt basically says student.
Yeah.
Right? You know, one of the most beautiful martial arts stories is how Kimura was buried with a white belt on.
Mm.
He is a master of judo. He is I don't even know how depth into a black belt, how many degrees into a black belt he was. But he was buried with a white belt on, and that's a statement of the eternal learner.
Yeah.
And so we see the white belt as being a learner, and then maybe a blue belt in real estate is someone who is expected to score deals at consistency.
Sure.
Right? So they have like a general wherewithal. And then when you get into a purple belt, you're normally looking for somebody who can maybe challenge belts higher, right? You're looking for somebody who has taken that blue belt's ability and really started to hone it against, maybe mark against other people in the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of go up to there from brown belt. And brown belt are those guys and ladies in real estate that they have their own game.
Mm.
Now you can tell that like they're carving out a little niche
style,
like
you patterns.
Probably, yeah. Yep, you probably rolled with a few people that you're like, yeah, try to stay out of this position because that's their like butter zone.
Yeah,
and you probably got a few of your own positions that you're constantly like, you know that people will underestimate you from those.
I've got two that I know, even the brown belts and the black belts, I get surprised sometimes with them. Just, and it's funny because some of it comes from like impingements I had before I had my hip surgery. You know, I couldn't move my leg a certain way, so I had to like adapt myself to succeed in other ways. And I think real estate's the same way, right? Like somebody that maybe naturally isn't great on video might find another pathway, and they're incredible writers or copywriters or networkers, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's some people that are known to be masters at basics.
Mm-hmm.
Like jiu-jitsu, it'd be like Hicks and Gracie. Where his movements are not considered to be complex, but they are so
combined.
Yeah, it's just incredible to see. And then there's other people that adapt in specific ways, like John Donaher, when he was don't ignore the 50% of the body.
Yeah.
So that's something that maybe I see from you in real estate, is the fact that you have you operate really well in residential environments. But then you have this access into investment real estate and in commercial real estate that is something that you don't see among your competition.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Actually, it's one of our biggest advantages. I call it focused diversification. It initially started because I was like, London's only 360,000 people. So I was like, if all I do are these deals, then like the scope's limited. If we build a Navy SEAL team where my commercial agent's working on a brand new industrial facility, like, I don't know, that facility needs to buy a house so he can call Rob. And then maybe that guy's kid's going to buy an investment property and he can call Jamie, right? So focused diversification creates an internal ecosystem. That's why we thought about it.
It's really interesting to see, is that's the way to unlock,
yeah,
right? Because a lot of people don't understand these chess moves where you're saying, okay, if I go here, I'm going to get what you're after anyway.
Yeah.
And by going to be able to help somebody like an entrepreneur who's buying a building for a business,
yeah,
then you're getting their residential business, where other people would be trying to compete for their residential business and that never coming to them.
I'm going to repeat myself because I just said this to Natalie and Eddie, but this is off the cuff. And I want to tell you this. I was talking to a developer 2 days ago. He said something to me that rang true and I want to hear with his home. And he said, like, you know, he's talking about a potential partnership with another big developer. And like, I'm their guy and this guy has their guy. And like, I immediately go into sell mode. I'm like, we're the best, right? I'm like, this is the reason. We crushed that guy. Last time I went up against him, I'm like, here's my platform. He's like, Justin, you don't have to sell me.
He's like, even if you were the number one agent, he's like, doesn't matter. He's like, if you were the number three agent, we'd choose you over the number one because of this. Right. And that really stuck with me because it, like, what you just said is so true. Like, it is a relationship game, and it's making sure that you're moving closer to actual relationship versus, hey, I'm just going to tell you whatever you want to hear to make this one sale on the building. And then you're just competing again. And you're always competing versus, like, you honor the relationship by proxy. They're going to call you and say, hey, Taylor, who do I call for this? And even if it's not you, somebody in your network, a referral partner that you have, like, by proxy, they're still getting Taylor. Taylor's eyes will be on in some capacity, and that's what you want at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, so, like, I see it as, in our business, as our three uniques. Like, we see ourselves as being experience first. We also see ourselves as being, connection over transaction.
Yeah.
Like, we really do value those connections, even if there isn't a transaction to be had. And then the other part of it is like a systemized team. So a group of specialists competing in a market of individual generalists.
Sure.
And so when we are going into situations where we might be competing for a listing, we're always drawing into those three uniques, just like someone in jiu-jitsu would draw into their strengths. And that's something that I noticed with you, is that you know how to make money in real estate. How could it be possible that somebody would come to you for a commercial deal where they see how you're able to determine, like, a good business decision,
mm-hmm.
and then trust someone else for their housing? Because many real estate agents are going to be a split between the two primary skills.
Yeah.
And one is finding people to help, and the other one is helping people.
Yeah.
And a lot of what you see as being number one are really good at finding people to help and not so good at helping people.
That's so true. Well, where do you think the biggest gap is between, hey, I found you, we're going to wrap you, to actually delivering on that service? Like, talk to the individual agents out there.
Well, you can see it when you talk to a lot of people about their business, like, how front-loaded are they? Like, you can see where they split their resources. If almost all their resources are in acquisition and they don't do anything in experience,
yeah.
that's where you can kind of see symptoms of the problem.
Yeah.
But it's how, I guess the process is the product, meaning I don't care what you tell me. Sure. Whatever happens is what you did.
Yeah.
Right? So in our business, 85% of our clients that work with us give us a 5-star review. So that is the product. The product is like honors when it comes to 5-star experience.
Yeah. Not dropping the ball, contract to close, not dropping the ball, closing day, like maintaining it. Can so many agents, I think, get the deal firm and then just ghost.
So all of those things have to happen as tasks.
Yeah.
But in order to land 5 stars, you have to be able to understand and manage expectations and then resist over-promising.
Yeah.
So that you can meet your deliverables.
Yeah.
Because in the client's eyes, what they see as being value is the mark between what you charge and what they get.
Mm.
That's what value is.
Yeah.
And if they don't see a value, well, then there is no hope for 5-star experiences and referrals and those types of things.
Mm.
So that's how I measure it. And I know that there's going to be a whole bunch of tasks that happen in the background. But if I ask my client about it, they wouldn't be able to quantify that, and they probably wouldn't care. Well, I just want it to happen.
Yeah. And like, being in it, you know what those are, but like, what was your discovery process to find out those tasks? Like, how did you pin down between here and here where the markers are that you could actually affect change?
Well, a lot of it is a game of mistakes.
Yeah.
But there's people that measure mistakes and people that don't. We see agents that have been in the business as long as I have, around 10 years. And in that period, they've gained 1 year of experience 10 times. Not so good.
I was talking to somebody about that recently, about how, like, early on in my career, people kept challenging me with me, like, how long have you been in real estate? I'm like, 3 years, but I did 50 deals last year, right? Like, how many transactions you're actually doing, how much knowledge you're searching for, how well do you know the market? Like, that can be very different between somebody that's been in the business for 4 years and somebody that's been in the business for 40 years.
Right? Yeah, take a look at like how we measure vehicles. You know, it's year and mileage.
Sure.
And there's so many agents that are long in years and low in mileage.
Yeah.
And are you in a better position to work with somebody who has years of experience not doing this very often?
Yeah.
Or are you better to work with someone who may not be as long in this business, but has a lot of relevant and recent activity?
Yep.
that is such a huge advantage. Those people that have been here for a long time, the reason that they don't do a very high cadence is a lot of the time they're not current. They haven't been changing and improving. And that's where you run into trouble, because the people they're competing with are the compounders.
Yeah.
People that have been in this business for 10 years and measured everything.
And right? made these micro tweaks over every year. Like, I, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Everybody, like you and I think our entire friendship was based on the fact that, like, if you look at when we met on Clubhouse 2.5 years ago, even to today, the amount of ideas we measured against each other, like, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Markets shifting, like going out and searching for knowledge, you coming here and speaking in front of that big group of people before you met me. I think that's the patterns of success that I tend to like to model of, you know, knowing that I don't have all the answers, you don't have all the answers, but we're willing to look at the data and then make these micro adjustments and adjust trajectory so that in two, like you talk about AI taking over real estate, I think 2025 to 2030, you're going to see a massive drop off in the number of agents. I think brokerages are really going to struggle because automation is going to come in place and the agents don't really need the brokerages past a certain point. Like, I consider what you do in your area to be a brokerage, a real estate company. Sure, you have a logo behind you, but like, regardless of the logo, you basically own a company that sells real estate.
Yep. The way we have core structures that support people, whether or not we were with our brokerage or independent.
Yep.
That's something that would remain the same. And that's the hard thing, is like actually creating an identity and creating systems that can support more than yourself.
Yeah.
Like, the majority of realtors in the marketplace are what we define as being solopreneurs.
Yeah.
And they have turned real estate into a job.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. And they help a lot of people, right? They tend to be really embedded in their community. The people that we would respect is maybe what we call professional realtors, those agents that are doing this well enough to stay in the business. And then we see other agents that are making structures that support other people. And that's where they kind of jump into entrepreneurship,
yep,
as opposed to being solopreneurs. And that was a big switch for me. And I actually tend to live on that side.
Yeah. Well, and we've gone back and forth on this a couple times too, about being in production, not being in production, running the company versus being a tactician. I know you made a pivot a couple of years ago where you noticed a big shift in the market and you picked up your shovel or your katana and you got back in the trenches with everybody to be like, all right, let's figure out how this works from a leadership perspective and then execute. That's why I said you run a company, not, you're not an agent to me, because of the fact that, like, if consumers look at brokerage, they assume that the real estate brokerage sells the houses. When I look at brokerage, I just see a company that does transaction management and accounting for a whole bunch of independent contractors. And I think we're going through a renaissance where there's going to be a separation of the individual agent, that is the professional agent, which is fantastic, and they're craftsmen at what they do and where they want to do it. And then you're going to see companies emerge from the brokerages where I actually think technology is going to empower those people to be able to run even more so as an independent company, maybe without any logo attached to themselves, in an ecosystem where the brokerage is supporting them in some capacity, different than it was before, where it was logo first and then agent. I feel like it's agent now first and then logo as the supporting.
Yeah, really, like, from a client perspective, I believe that companies don't make relationships.
Yeah.
Only people make relationships. And the people and the companies that can employ the best relationship people are going to do really well.
Chick-fil-A. Their customer service bonkers, right?
Like,
We catered our family reunion with them. They called me at night. And then, like, I had a great conversation with a guy in Nashville. I thought he was from Canada. I thought he was the guy from London. And then we talked for 10 minutes. And I'm like, hey, where are you based from? He said, oh, I'm in Nashville. And it's like, we were friends. We were done. Like, well, we are going to cater all the time. So, you know, here's my number. Let's figure it out.
Amazing.
Here, right? But it was a human connection that I actually had with the person on the other side of the phone.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see. You were mentioning market cycles and how people can change. Like, I left production for about 3 years. And I was sitting down with my kids the other day, and my wife was telling the story about her dog sledding.
Yeah.
And she was saying, you know, I didn't understand what the relationship were with the dogs. Like, when you go on a horse carriage, you know, the driver drives and there's not really much else going on. But they were explaining that when you're behind this small team of dogs with one person in the sleigh and one person driving, that when you come to a hill, you're expected to hop off the sleigh and run along.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's right. And then you'll go down the hill. And that's how it works. Now, my wife gets on the sleigh and she goes up the hill and she does what she's supposed to and she hops off and she runs along. And then the next hill seems a little smaller. So she decides she's going to ride this one out. Well, when they say that you're expected to run, the dog says, who expects you to run?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, all these sled dogs are looking over their shoulder at her, giving her like side eye.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? And I think that there's a lot of team leaders that are in that spot right now.
Mm.
Where the market is moving, and these team leaders are like what
they're
teams. They're dynamic.
Yeah,
they're these big figures that can shake things and make things happen.
Sure.
But they've been riding on the sleigh for a long time.
Yeah.
And so now all their teammates are looking back over their shoulders, saying like, "Hey, what's going on?"
Yeah.
And there's a few of these people that are not getting off the sled. I love markets like this for picking up talent.
Yeah.
I think that there should be some other teams that are really looking at some of those great players.
Yeah.
That have team leaders that have kind of checked out.
That's an interesting perspective. Somebody, Brian Edstock, said this a couple months ago. He's in number one Nissan in the world. And Jordan, right? Like, he is a driver. Have you seen Ben Stock stuff online? Dude, you'll love this guy. He's like a target. And he was talking about how he had a friend opened a $12 million dealership in Miami or something like that. And he was all excited for his buddy. And he's like, he's all about growth and business, great opportunity. You're going to employ 100 people. You're going to change their lives. Like, Brian creates culture in Jersey with his Toyota Paragon, so it's called. And then this guy goes to open up the dealership. Brian calls to go down there on open the year. He's going to hop on a private plane, go down and see this guy. And the guy answered the phone. He's like, "Oh yeah, he's not here." He's like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Oh, he's on vacation in Costa Rica or something." Brian lost it. Called his buddy. He's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "You are the leader of that organization. You just spent that much money opening your doors for that facility. You're not there leading the charge. That will set the tone for your culture for the rest of the 5 or 10 years. The lack of leadership will be found. It will be self-defined, and it may not be the leadership that you want, right?" And I think we saw that when the market shifted big time in terms of, you know, who I was trying to get around to get leadership from my perspective, and then impart it back to the team so that we were well-equipped. When, you know, Tressa came around, which was a huge change in our organized real estate, I was at the Tressa meeting going to other agents there, asking them like, "Hey, what have you guys done to prep for this?" And I had agents that work at massive brokers be like, "I have no idea. Our leadership's told us nothing."
Wow.
And like, these regulatory changes are coming in 2 days. And I'm like, you have no idea how to handle this? They're like, "No, what are you doing?" Dear God. But again, opportunity zones, right? I think there's an opportunity to look for ways you don't want to act, and then find people who want what you're building within your ecosystem.
I think more people should really look into those examples around them and start to like make criteria for what is a good example and what is a not good example. Because we see so many examples. We're in this age of social media, and it's kind of funny. Like, for example, with making video online, like, you're a great video producer, but you're also a very great producer in real estate. How many agents do you know that make movies to sell real estate? And how many agents do you know that sell real estate to make movies?
Yeah. I think there's a big identity problem in general too, where some of them want to sell real estate and become an influencer. Some of them want to make movies to build a funnel and become a recruiter. I think people think that they don't understand the model of what they're actually trying to create. I think that's one of the biggest problems. And even us, like, we're very big on slowing down right now because we know the next 3 years we'll create our core identity for the next 10 or 15,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that's a big question people have to ask themselves. Are you chasing the virality because you want the fame so that you can use that to recruit people and never sell a house in your life? Cool, if that's what you want to do, there's a model for that, and no comes against you. But just be very clear about what you're actually doing versus if you're trying to be a craftsman and serve consumers, that's a very different thing. And I think sometimes people, streamers do this all the time on like Twitch and platforms where they create this life for themselves that they think they want, and then they get trapped in it, and then some of them commit suicide and do all kinds of things because of the fact that they feel this burden, right? Like, I've had YouTubers tell me that people that have created massive YouTuber accounts have completely fallen apart once they've achieved what they thought they wanted, because
it's a treadmill,
and they weren't clear on the reason why they wanted that actual thing, right?
So you think that that's a failure in goal setting? Is that they couldn't clearly enough see what that would be like to do that?
Yeah, I think it's attaching yourself to the results, right? Like, attaching your success to achieving somebody else's versions of success. So like a streamer, for example, that says, "I want to be like Mr. Beast," or I want to be like this Twitch star because their life is so great. They have all these millions of followers. They're making millions of dollars. Look at the NPC trend on TikTok, right? Like,
I understand it. Some of them are making $700 to $2,000 a day. So you're talking $260,000 a month. But what does that do for them in the long run in terms of the seeds that they're planting today? Like, is it just about the money? Because eventually, once you have the money, what's your life going to be like for the rest of your life, right? And I think our industry is one of the worst in terms of showcasing this is who you want to be in real estate. This is what you have to do to be that person. Where you and I know some of the most influential people in real estate are an influencer. And some of the least influential people are. Right?
They would be considered secret agents.
Yeah.
Right? For sure. And they've got higher kill counts than you think.
Yeah. And they're happier. And they're actually, like, respected much more than some people may think.
So switching gears a little bit. Now, you've been in real estate a fair amount of time, but have you seen a down cycle like you're seeing right now? Previously?
When I got in the industry, yeah, it was dead. Yeah, our market was, nobody cared about it. Our average days on market was 365 in one of my secondary markets.
Cool.
I joke because we were called the closers. I still own the trademark and the website. So it was my wife and I. And I wanted to sell one house in like one neighborhood. And I got a listing and then it didn't sell for like 6 months. And I still told my wife, I said, if somebody's smart, they're going to take our sign. They're going to take away the C. Everybody's going to be known as the losers or the listers, right? And we had to scrap to like just find a way. But I think scrapping and doing the work, it was the refiner's fire. Like we inferred away the chafe, thought like, you know, but we wanted to be an agent that sold a lot of houses in one neighborhood. And then we realized we wanted more. We became that. And they were like, okay, let's take the good pieces of that. Let's leave the bad. Let's set another goal. And then we found ways that we actually enjoyed doing the business that were different, which was content creation. Mm-hmm. So doing videos, I saw Gary Vee's talk to Remax actually back in 2013 or 14.
Yep.
And started doing daily videos and people made fun of me and I didn't get a lot of views and I had no 500 followers, but I would see people on the street and they would call me and they would work with us. And like, I kept seeing these indicators, these active indicators of success versus the latent indicators of success, like Andy T likes to say, where I wasn't searching to just be the number one guy at the number one brokerage. I was really searching for what is the activity that I do that brings me happiness to success, and try and always march towards that. And I have in the past found things that I chased that I discovered were not what I wanted, and then had to like shut the door on those things and recalibrate and then go a different direction, which I'm sure you don't say anything, right?
Yeah, well, my market was one of the most challenged for the longest times. You know, like we had over 11 months of inventory in condos.
Yeah.
And when you have the bottom of your market freeze solid,
yeah,
you lose all the vertical.
Because nobody's so if selling the that to buy that.
Yeah. The $200,000 condo doesn't sell in my market. It doesn't create the $300,000 townhouse buyer.
Yeah.
And that's really the price points that we're dealing with. So in Edmonton right now, you can still see a 5% list to sale difference on average on condos.
Oh, wow.
And a 900 square foot, two bedroom, two bathroom is like 275 near downtown.
Huh.
Isn't that crazy?
That's wild.
So we've been watching this a little bit because now it's starting to sweep in a different direction. Typically, we take a look at the city about 300 kilometers away from us, Calgary.
Yeah.
As some type of indicator because Calgary naturally gets more flow.
Sure.
It's considered the access to the mountains. There's lots of people. Corporate headquarters.
Yeah.
And Calgary is what makes the business in Alberta happen. And Edmonton is what does the work.
Interesting.
So right now, we are just massively consuming people moving in. Mm. Like Edmonton is trending on realtor.ca and that's silly.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, there's 7.6 million people in the greater Toronto area that don't even know that Edmonton exists.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And still, Edmonton is trending. So right now, we're considering it undervalued, and here's one metric. The average property in our market, when we're talking like three-bedroom house, fully finished basement, double-car garage, that's coming out in around $430,000.
That's a good price point.
Well, Calgary's 3 hours away, and benchmark price there is $680 now.
There you go.
So I really think that there's a lot of value changing in our market. And historically,
yeah,
Alberta does well when everybody else does poorly.
Well, we've seen that, you and I, like in literally month-to-month conversations where it's like we were going crazy and then we slow down a couple months later, you're going crazy and then we slow down. And we do it in the GTA, so we're based out of London, Ontario. GTA happens and then it comes down the highway.
So when I talk to my like Heddle in Hamilton or anybody that I'm friends with in other markets, I'll call them and then tell my team, hey, like it's starting, it's coming to us in like 30, 45 days. Like, let's get to work. And then it trickles down to like London. And then London goes to Grand Bend and Port Stanley, which are towns of like 2,000 people. So it's the same effect. It's interesting how it's human behavior, right? Is people from Toronto are like, I want to leave the big city, so I'm going to move to Kitchener. People from Kitchener are like, I want to move to Hamilton. I want to go to a small town. Hamilton to London. I want to move to a small town. They leave London to go to Grand Bend because they want to move to a small town. And it's, this game really is a game of attention and understanding human behavior more than anything else, I think.
Totally. And I think that's the biggest thing that people should be looking for if they're concerned about the market.
Yeah.
Is what you really need to do is reveal who can win and show them how.
Yeah.
That's like where all the money is ever made. They don't understand that they're in a winning position. The market says that they, or the news says that this is a bad market. It's not a bad market for everyone. It can't actually be a bad market for everybody. It's either a good market if you're a buyer or a good market if you're a seller. And those families of kids that are upgrading, they need to realize that they're buying more than they're selling. So it's time to come in.
It's funny you say that. So I think it's four markets. So I think it's two markets for buyers and sellers. We should probably go in the car after this too. Two markets for buyers and sellers, two markets for buyers, two markets for sellers. You have some buyers that are not going to be able to buy today and they need to go to emerging markets and they're not going to be able to compete. And then there's buyers that have tons of cash and they can throw offers on nine properties a day if they really want to, lowball everything and get a crazy view. And then there's sellers that absolutely won't be able to maintain their mortgage for another year. They're going to lose their house and they need to make a decision. And there's sellers that have all the cash in the world, don't owe anything on the house, and they can fight for their price. So it is really understanding the art of the deal, where you're at in the actual marketplace and reacting not emotionally to real estate, which is, I think, the reason 80% of people fail in this business on the agent side and the consumer side is emotion more than anything else. Let's hop in the car.
Have you been in Ontario before?
Yeah. The real estate actually opened most of my travel.
Okay.
So I was a kid from Saskatchewan. I moved to Alberta when I was 10, and I didn't see the ocean until I was 25.
Wow.
Yeah, like my family just couldn't afford to travel anywhere.
Yeah.
In fact, my family...
Well, yeah, and you're literally in the middle of Canada with, like, as far as from any oceans as you could possibly be, right?
Totally. And, like, when your family is a family of six that owns a five-passenger van...
Yeah.
You're riding as part of the luggage for most of it, and you're not going that far.
Strapped in the roof.
Now, what was your child like growing up?
My childhood?
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
You know, like, my family relocated. My dad was an entrepreneur, and it didn't work out.
What did he do?
It worked out later, I guess. Yeah. In Saskatchewan, he managed, owned a branch of NestGI, Saskatchewan General Insurance.
Okay.
And then just, you know what, late 80s, rough time.
Yeah.
So we moved to Sherwood Park, Alberta, just outside of Edmonton. I did stuff like hockey and things like that, but school really didn't turn out. And so I had a lot of challenges there.
Mm-hmm.
But through sales is where I kind of found myself. And then through real estate, things started to really shake and move.
How did you end up in real estate? I don't know if I ever asked you that question.
Well, I dropped out of high school and I was working at this appliance shop.
Okay.
Delivering appliances. And it was awful.
Yeah.
Right? Like, carrying fridges over fences. People tip the delivery guy for pizza. They don't tip the fridge guy.
That's wild.
And I was making $7 an hour.
Yeah.
Right? It was just not good. But I had to move out, so I had to make this stuff kind of work.
Sure.
And then I noticed that the salespeople were complaining about having to clean the appliances in the show. I was like, those are the problems I want.
Yeah. Not tipping a fridge over a fence with two straps that may or may not kill you.
So I was determined to get this sales job, but instead they hired the sales manager's brother.
Of course.
And that was what... Now, luckily, I'd had a couple of negotiations prior to this, and they were in police interrogation rooms. So I felt really good in holding the owner of this company hostage, and I knew how. I just told him, I quit.
Yeah.
And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, you said you guys would rather have the sales manager's brother as a salesperson, and your competitor said that they'd take me.
Yeah.
And he said, his eyes went wide. He's like, how long will it take you to train somebody to run the truck?
Because he needed you on the truck. You almost made yourself too valuable in that aspect, and you probably...
That's what had happened.
Yeah.
So then I came out of the sales floor, and things just started to click. right? There was experienced salespeople, and I was running past.
Yeah.
And finally, they had problems with, like, my bonus structure. And so I got hauled out behind this little Maytag shop by the sales manager, and he's like, listen, we can't pay you anymore. Like, I make 40 grand.
Wait, they were looking at how much money you were making. They had an issue with it?
Yes. And so he's like, we can't pay him anymore. I make 40 grand. And I was like, you make $40,000? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, I quit. He's like, what? Yeah. I was like, no. If you make 40, then I'm out. And so I found my way into car sales.
Interesting.
By begging for a job.
Yeah.
Like, I found one guy that would talk to me. And he's like, yeah, just drop off a resume. I was like, we both know what happens to resume that get dropped off from reception.
Yeah.
I was like, what time of day are you least busy? I will be there every day this week.
Yeah.
So finally, I'm like 18 years old, sitting in like a Toyota Lexus dealership with the new car manager. The average salesperson is 40 years old, and he doesn't know what to do with himself because he's never found a 40-year-old that will follow up like this.
Mm.
So he's like, I got to ask you some weird questions. Do you own a car? I'm like, yeah. He's like, do you live with your parents? Like, no. He's like, well, I got to go talk to the owner now and explain that I just hired you. And he's going to be upset about that. And he's going to ask me if you really need the money or if you're just doing this so we'll give you a car.
That's funny how his brain, people with brains work, right? Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the owner there, for the first year, he wouldn't talk to me.
Mm.
He would shuffle through. He was like a 7-year-old man. He would shuffle through the showroom. And he would say hi to all the other salespeople. And then I'd be like, morning, Herb. And he'd just shuffle past.
Interesting.
And so finally, I asked the sales manager, I was like, what's the deal here? Is he not like me? He's like, you know, I never knew that was the case. Next time I'm in his office, I'll ask him.
Yeah.
And so a couple weeks later, he says, oh, yeah, I asked Herb why he doesn't talk to you. He says, you're young. And he's seen young.
That's it on.
So these are the environments in which I was cutting my teeth.
Yeah.
They didn't know what was about to happen next, but I was about to run all of their salespeople.
Interesting.
And it only took me a few months, and then I just made it to the top of the heap. After that, they promoted me. And when I left, I had a job offer to be one of the youngest Lexus managers.
This was in Saskatchewan?
No, this was in Edmonton.
Edmonton, sorry. So, appliance store and car store.
Yes.
Like, what was the secret to success in terms of running past these sales?
Well, it was just about understanding what's missing. So at this time, there was a lot of problems because people weren't identifying that there was two decision makers. They were only talking to men. And I came from a class.
Yep.
How to talk to everybody and how joint decisions worked, right?
So joint decisions. I just bought a treadmill and it was not a joint decision.
But the truth of the matter is that, like, if you were able to profile people, like if you and your wife came in, I'd be like, man, Justin's a great guy. And I know every great guy is just trying to make his wife happy. So if I can lose her, I win.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Actually, the guy that got the sale on the treadmill was just there to answer the question she had for me. And it was actually more the concern of, like, removing the old treadmill and us not having to deal with movers. And he actually ended up giving us a free year membership to this software that comes with it. And, like, the experience with that sales rep, night and day from the other guy that I had called for the device. And it was because he was making my wife happy by proxy, by answering the questions that I knew were coming down the pipeline.
Totally. So those are, like, core skills.
Yeah.
Right? And then after that, it's about efficiencies. So if you can get really good, so for me as a salesperson, because I was so young, people would be like, okay, I'd like to test drive. And they'd be like, all right, I'll pull it around. And they'd look at me and be like, you have a license? And it was kind of funny. So I had to be really technical. I had to win their credibility in other ways. So that's what worked. And then it was efficiency. So I was only allowed to talk to new people 6 hours a day, but the dealership was open 12 hours a day. So by scheduling anyone who was coming to see me in my off time, I would leave those 6 hours open only for new people, and I was the only person who did that.
Interesting. Everybody else probably just booked the time in at this one here, and then they filled it with their repeat customers, right?
Yeah, and then most of the salespeople would be kind of hanging out near the front door, and they'd be looking for new people coming in, but nobody was hanging out in service.
Interesting.
And service was a place where people had already bought cars.
Gold mine.
They already liked cars,
yeah.
Right? And I knew that based on the profile of people that buy new cars, Once they're 4 or 5 years old, they're ready to go again.
Yeah.
So by making friends with service advisors, they would tell me when the model years of the stuff I wanted would come in.
100%.
And now car dealerships have computerized this, and this is all done now. But when I started, it wasn't happening.
There's still, yeah, but what you're describing, I can tell you whenever I buy a new vehicle, is usually from a relationship with somebody who reminds me, hey, Justin, go buy a car. Like, it's literally, I'm like, oh, amazing. Thank you for reminding me. This is where my kilometers are at. This is what my value is going to be. Like, there's so much inherent value in that efficiency. I told Lindsay this on the real estate side, too. Our investor database, we just brought in 100 new investors to our database from the summit that we did. But I told her more than anything, I said, Q1 2024, I want to print off a list of every single investor that's ever done a deal with us. And I want to go deep into that list because half of them are probably going to want to sell the properties and don't know how much money they've made. And the other half just probably want to come hang out and have a coffee and meet other investors doing stuff. And by proxy, that will probably generate more business and more opportunities for them and for us at the same time, right?
So your compounding effects are always awesome. You know, like every deal that anyone ever does in real estate, it comes from either a relationship or an activity, and it's filtered through skill.
Yeah.
And so what you're doing is compounding your relationships with activities and at high skill. And you really can't not get results with that.
Yeah, it's funny, but your comments about the efficiency of the decision maker, I'm going to take about that back to the team specifically, because I think for my newer agents, I don't know if I've reminded them of that lately, that like, hey, if you're meeting a family, you really do need to know where the decision maker is, what's actually important to them. Because it may surprise you, like we can be assumptive, assuming we know, but then in reality, we don't, right? Like sometimes it's buried and doesn't expose itself until you go through the transaction. And on the efficiency side, I thought of another time in our business where Mark Tyson and I, we would bring in investors from the summit. We would book our calendar for the next 2 weeks, giving every single new investor a 2-hour tour of London, Ontario, in our cars, showing them properties with no idea of if they were pre-qualified or not. And he was like, dude, I'm going to quit, is literally what he said to me. I'm like, no, we'll figure this out. And we just got better at qualification and like doing virtual tours with them and stuff like that. It made a big, big difference.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I take a look at where that earning early in my sales career manifests itself now, it's through solving a problem that almost no one else can see.
Yeah.
So in the majority of residential real estate decisions, we again get two decision makers.
Yep.
And almost every situation, there's one person that wants to move and they're married to someone who doesn't like change.
Sure.
So we get access to the person who wants to move.
Interesting.
And that's our point of contact for both of them. But then we end up with a dynamic that's really hard to spot, which is the reason that the person that doesn't like change is more resistant is because our great strategy is being sent to the other person and then filtered through their relationship to them.
Yeah.
Ruh-roh.
Oh, dude, it's the worst. On new dev sites, this happens all the time. So you'll get a buyer call because the wife's like, hey, get information on that. He calls you. You tell him, hey, we have these three incentive packages. We have these models. We have all this information. And he goes, okay. He calls his wife. What'd the guy say? Oh, no, he's just trying to sell me something, right? Like,
you got it.
And then you lose the deal.
And even if your strategy is getting through, it's no longer your strategy, it's her strategy. And the credibility of that strategy is based on her past performance, not yours.
And interpretation of what message maybe got to her, and if it was 25% of your message interpreted in a different way, they're already having an assumption.
We are all aware of this problem.
Yeah.
We all feel like we're doing really well, and then we keep getting the rug pulled out by the second decision maker. And that can be solved with video. So we send video by email using BombBomb. And the reason we do it is because then both parties get the message with our tone and inflection. And they're not under the time pressure of a phone call. We don't have to organize them being together for a phone call. They can re-watch it. And then they both get the original intended message and can talk to each other with that complete information. And I have to say that with listings specifically, that is a major unlock.
We do it with a lot of Lou. So I'll do like, I actually started doing my opinion of value on a Lou for the meeting on purpose so that they can hear it delivered and that there's no back and forth. I'm like, and this isn't a discussion, this just is. Here are the comps. Here's why everything looks the way it is. Here's the state of the market. We'll talk about it a little bit. And then when we're there, we're using the same set of data and they understand the context to the conversation, it saves me probably 45 minutes of the actual meeting of doing that all again.
And the other thing is that meetings should be an exchange of insight.
Yeah.
And pre-meeting should be an exchange of information.
That's a great way to think about it.
Because you need a barrier between information and insight. Otherwise, you just what you're seen as from the other side is just having an opinion.
Yeah. And again, if you show up with an opinion rather than an exchange of ideas, when you show up, they've already made an assumption that you're there to tell them that you had a lead so you can resign the listing for 4 months. Or like that you really have a hard time breaking down the walls and trying to tell them like no, this is the state of affairs. This is actually a great deal or a great plan for your property. And having a discussion about it, you're having to overcome these walls. I think video is the future that way too. I think doing things by Loom and sending them videos or by BombBomb is super, super effective. Does BombBomb allow you to, like, do you record internal training stuff on BombBomb or is it strictly client-to-client communication?
I've done many things with it. So I use it inside my CRM for client-to-client communication.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also do screen share. Especially if I'm communicating with people like virtual assistants with English as a second language,
sure.
Tell them instead of write to them. For the love, tell them. They can hear, like, almost everyone who's bilingual is better at speaking than reading.
Yeah, it's true.
And so approaching that was a really big unlock when it came to like graphic design and other things. And then I started to do that more and more.
Yeah.
Now what we're looking to do is build a training library with screen shares.
Because you could, like, does BombBomb allow you to do that internally? So if I make 10 videos, this is how I do my CMA. I could train that and then send it to my agents?
Yeah, I'm not sure how you would post it or organize it, but yeah. You could definitely do that inside of that.
Well, you could just do email templates and follow bots.
Yep.
And then have an action plan and send like all those videos, or they can go into the action plan to see the actual videos.
Yeah, one more thing in that regard is with contracts. With sending paperwork to clients for electronic signing,
yeah,
I like it from a compliance standpoint, because if we were ever audited and somebody said, hey, I didn't understand that paperwork,
yeah,
we actually preview it all by video and not a repeated, reused, canned video.
So how do you do
your paperwork every time?
Every time.
Every
time. How long does it take you guys to do that?
5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, we overview the paperwork, but then we cannot be, like, we have irrefutable evidence that it was reviewed, and we have open rates and click-throughs and opportunities for that client to make a reasonable decision. So I think that people that might be missing that might not see that there's a huge gap in compliance. And if somebody argues
that's
that
genius.
A paperwork wasn't explained well, that you would have no way. It would be he said, she said. You wouldn't be able to defend yourself.
Interesting. Yeah, so with Tressa, there's a major compliance gap with people where you have this information guide that has to be provided and explained to the consumer every single time. And agents are talking about, oh, I'm just going to put the link in my email and then send a Loom video. I'm like, you're going to be in front of a court of law. And you're gonna use that as your excuse for compliance. You're gonna be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, like, and you know, it's a lot about compliance.
It's a scary, scary thing. I think it's a good opportunity for us, but I think that's a really good way to solve that.
See, I'm from a part of the world that did two things. We resisted taxes because taxes make rules, and we don't have taxes or many rules.
Yeah,
we're the most landlord friendly province out there.
It's true.
And that's something that we take pride on. So I feel bad for you with your regulatory challenges, and I hope you keep your regulations to yourself.
We will.
Well, hopefully you got as much value as I did from this episode. Make sure to share it out. Leave a review on the show so you could potentially be this month's winner, and we'll see you on the next one.